Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books and Fantasy and Adventure, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Today, we'll be talking with Matthew Binder about his new book, The Absolved. This is your host, Gabrielle Matthew, author of the historical Fantasy Falcon series. Before I welcome Matthew Binder on the show, let me share a bit about the book. Henry, our narrator, is a middle-aged doctor, one of the few employed people left in the U.S. Though the reader suspects his job might be in danger, the hospital administrator, Serena, keeps reducing staff. A large sector of the population, the absolved, are free from doing any work and receive a guaranteed minimum income. Their days are spent watching sports on TV or, like Henry's wife, Rachel, staying productive with charity work. Another contingent of people can't register for the guaranteed income. They're known as the feudal. Political upheaval results as another election draws near. The liberal president who promised jobs has been unable to deliver, and a demagogue throws his hat into the ring for the highest office. However, Henry remains an ironic observer of society. He is too preoccupied by his affair with a failed medical student, his demanding wife, and his shots of whiskey at a dive bar to engage. That is, until he sacrifices his own career for his mistress, and his life begins to unravel. A little bit about Matthew. He is the author of the novels High in the Streets and The Absolved. He is also a primary member of the recording project Bang Bang Jetaway. His website is www.matthewbinder.net. His name is spelled MATTHEWBINDER.net. He's also on Twitter as @mbinder711. Thanks for joining me today. I've got Matthew Binder from New York City on the show talking about his book, The Absolved.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good, thanks. And how are you this morning?
I'm doing very well. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Great. Well, let's jump into the questions about your book. I would say it's kind of a genre blend. You know, perhaps it might be filed under science fiction in a bookstore, but I don't know. It seems like it has social satire elements, too. How would you categorize your book, Matthew?
Yeah, I guess while I was writing The Absolved, I was never like actively thinking about it as a science fiction book. That never really occurred to me. I mean, it's a dystopian future novel. It takes place in the near future, about 20 years from when I wrote it. I totally thought of it as a social satire. And it was like only in the lead up to the book's publication that it sort of gets slapped with this science fiction label. And that's always been sort of like a little bit of a fear of mine that the label is, you know, the science fiction label is misleading, and that anyone who picks up the book because they thought it was a science fiction book, that they would be sort of disappointed because, I don't know, there's no time travel or trips to space or aliens or anything like that. And I don't know, you know, I don't know what people expect when they see the label science fiction, but yeah, to answer your question, I thought of it more as a social satire.
I actually think it is too. And as for science fiction, there are so many subcategories now. So for our listeners, this is not a space opera. It is not a time travel book. And it is not a military science fiction book, which is going to be really heavy on descriptions of advanced weaponry. What it's about is how mankind will or will not adjust to the fact that AIs do our jobs much more efficiently than we ever did.
Yeah.
So many books in the fantasy and science fiction category, and this is the Fantasy Channel, so that's why I'm bringing it up, they deal with themes such as individuation, the conquest of evil, etc. And there were parts of your novel that engaged with topics more familiar to readers of literary writers like Philip Roth. Now, I haven't read Philip Roth, but just Henry, our narrator, he seems to venerate his wife, and yet he can't stop having affairs. And in that sense, it reminded me kind of the travails of a middle-aged man. I found it interesting that his current mistress echoed the way his wife, Rachel, used to be. And I wondered why it was that marriage transformed Rachel from a mysterious waif to a dominating, cold, busybody. Or is she maybe not a cold, dominating, busybody?
Yeah, let's see. There's a lot to that. You know, Henry and his wife have been together a long time, you know, and my sort of limited life experience, I sort of think that it's generally some sort of passion that what brings two people together at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
But like long-term love isn't necessarily about passion. Passion sort of fades, and long-term relationships are more about partnership and shared goals. And in the book, I think Henry refers to it as duty, this partnership, this marriage. But, you know, I think, you know, people are still animals, and sexual passion is still a vital part of being alive. And I think, you know, for Henry, it's probably unrealistic that his wife of a lot of years is, you know, able to be all things to him, right? So the person he raises children with, the person he pays his taxes with, the person he takes care of when they're sick. And, you know, on top of that, the person is also supposed to be the person he wants to have sex with the most. I you know, it seems unlikely for a character like Henry. And so, there's a lot of conflict there. Like, he loves his wife, but, you know, he sort of sees in Taylor, maybe that's his mistress, you know, something that attracted him to his wife when he was younger that she, you know, no longer possesses. So, you know, he's attracted to this sort of younger version of his wife.
Yeah, Rachel doesn't seem to be too excited about Henry either.
No, I would say that she tolerates him at best.
Well, a related question to Henry's affair. I also struggled with Henry's character. His observations are certainly funny, and he's an interesting way to explore the future. And he's got good traits. He's very intelligent. He does demonstrate caring. For instance, in the first third of the book, he helps an unemployed truck driver with his dog. He tries to intervene for an older patient whose family insists on chemotherapy. On the other hand, he seems at the mercy of people who aren't sympathetic, specifically women, such as his wife, Rachel, and his friend, Serena. Does he admire Rachel and Serena? And if so, why does he admire them?
I think sort of a lot of people, you know, the book's detractors certainly have complained that some of the characters are too unlikable, and that Henry behaves, you know, specifically the narrator behaves badly. I mean, I guess I see him as, like maybe a bit, like he's definitely like a little bit weak and craven, but ultimately I don't think he's malicious. I think he wants to do well in the world. He's just he sort of thinks of, he falls victim to temptation quite frequently. And I sort of see this a lot in contemporary literature, and I don't know if it's specific to, you know, the books today or the reading audience today, or it's just that I'm writing books today and so I'm more aware of it. But there's like this appetite for these stories of like real like human triumph and moral uplift, and mm-hmm. It kind of seems to me that like adhering to like these like prescriptive social norms about how people are supposed to act and how we want them to act is more important than like realistic portrayals of how people actually behave in the real world. And this actually recently, like this a reviewer who wrote a review of the book pointed out something that I thought was really interesting. They said, you know, most contemporary dystopian future stories are basically told from the point of view of like the hyper oppressed victim, right? And that allows readers to sort of be on this moral high ground as they go through the story and feel like they are like sort of unstained by any sort of compromise. But The Absolved is told from the point of view of a hyper ethically challenged card carrying member of the elite who's, you know, sort of desperately clinging to any sort of semblance of power that he has in his life. And it makes a lot of readers sort of deeply uncomfortable. Yeah.
Well, I think that's one reason it strays into literary fiction territory, because it's not a heroic story. In fact, it's more like a Dr. Strangelove story, and you have to be the kind of reader who enjoys absurd twists, and the twists in the novel would not work with the heroically constructed character. It definitely works with Henry's character, where even though, you know, it's an absurd twist, it makes sense in the context of who he is and his surrounding. And it's supposed to be absurd to highlight the possible insanity of where we could be going.
I couldn't have said it better myself.
I don't even know what I said, but I'm glad you think so.
But I'm glad it's been recorded now, so I can use
quote that to your words. Detractors.
Exactly.
And he really looks up to Serena, and I think perhaps he admires her ruthless qualities. Is that it?
I think, you know, in the book, most of society is, you know, they've been displaced by AI and automation, and they're sort of like they're called the absolved in the book because they've been absolved of the burden of work, and they're sort of basically like a useless class of people. Like they have their lives don't necessarily have that much purpose. They're sort of rootless. But Serena is sort of like the paragon of like being successful in this, you know, sort of in this world where most people are unable to compete. She's been incredibly successful, and she does exactly what she wants to do, and she doesn't apologize for her success, and
that's,
you know,
true.
She has mm-hmm. insatiable appetites for you know, for a lot of things like power and money and even sex, and you know, he admires the fact that that she has been so successful in a world where not so many people are successful.
She's kind of like Henry's id without a super ego.
That's right.
Just a series of drives. Well, I mentioned a chemotherapy in a previous question, and the description of Henry's patient, whose family practically forces him to get chemotherapy, it reminded me of my experiences in the field as a professional, not as a patient, luckily. I do know that chemotherapy, in some cases of incurable cancer, is referred to in professional circles as salvage therapy, which kind of tells you right there, I think, it doesn't sound very good. And I wondered what your experience with end-of-life issues was and what you would like the reader to reflect on.
Yeah. So my father, he's an oncologist, uh-huh. And my brother is also an oncologist. And sort of the impetus behind this book came from a conversation I had with my brother. At one point, he said, we were talking about AI and automation displacing people from the workforce. And he said something along the lines of, you know, in the future, people will just have to work harder to cultivate a skill set that'll make them indispensable in the economy the way that I have. And I pointed out to him, like, well, yeah, I think AI will probably be making better medical decisions than you in 20 years. And so that was sort of the impetus behind the book. But in terms of how I think about dying and sort of end of life care, you know, I think I wrote in the book, you know, that technology isn't necessarily like slowing the aging process. It's slowing the dying process.
Mm-hmm.
And, I've seen, you know, firsthand from family and, you know, I think there is a loss that living too long can be like a loss in the sense that, like, I don't think that I would like to live too long after I've been robbed of, you know, my abilities to be creative or to contribute to society or work. And also I think about legacy a lot, you know, like my, and I talk about this a little bit in the book, or I write about this in the book, like, for instance, my grandparents, they've all passed away now, for instance, but, you know, two of them went very quickly, sort of while they're at the peak of their powers. I mean, they were, you know, they weren't sickly.
Mm-hmm.
And then two of them had very like prolonged illnesses. And my memories of them, like the ones, my memories of my family members who died quickly are of them, you know, sort of still at the peak of their powers and being competent and smart and funny and great. But like my memories of my family members who suffered from very like prolonged illnesses, any good memories of them have sort of been displaced by memories of, you know, them just being sort of dependent and sickly. And
it's very diminishing to have a chronic illness that you'll eventually die from. And some countries actually have end of life laws in place, like the country that I live in, but I know in other places like the U.S., it's a very hotly contested issue.
Yeah, and I also think, you know, and it's probably not PC to say so, but like it's also, you know, there's an economic part of it too,
mm-hmm.
right? Like we spend so much money on care, like this, you know, we should be treating like doing a lot of like palliative care, like you were saying, you know, making people feel comfortable as they're dying, but like, you know, spending tens of thousands of dollars to do dialysis on a patient who's in their mid 90s just doesn't make a whole lot of economic sense. And we just spend so much money on end of life care.
Right. It doesn't, because even if we're looking at it from a liberal perspective, a people centered perspective, rather than thinking, well, that money should stay with the Koch brothers, excuse me. Even if we're looking at it from a people-centered perspective and a compassionate perspective, we could be thinking that money could be used for school lunches for kids who are getting inadequate nutrition, or for a training program for at-risk city youth or something to maybe improve the lives of those who still have their life ahead of them.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess another component of it, I have my father's friend who's an oncologist. He's from India. He's older. He's 80 years old or so, but he's very healthy. But we had this conversation once, and he wrote a series of articles about it, and maybe even a book. But like, it's part of the difference between like Western civilization and Eastern culture is in the West, it's so individualistic, in that so people like sort of cling to life mm-hmm. at all costs because, you know, the individual is all that all that anyone has, where in Eastern culture, where he's from in India, like people are more comfortable with the process of dying because it's not just about the individual. It's more of, you know, a collective, and it's more about the family. And it's like when one person passes, like not all is lost, like the family still lives. And, it's not so individualistic. And I think that has a lot to do with the way we treat death in the West.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Well, let's get back to the absolved, right? Because we were talking about Henry and how he admires Serena because she's still working. But the absolved have no job stress. They have a guaranteed minimum income. Gee, that sounds wonderful. What could go wrong?
What could go wrong there? I mean, a big part of the book is about what happens when there's not work for people to do, right? So, mm-hmm. you know, there's all the San Francisco futurist type folks who think that, you know, once people are absolved of the burden of work, that they'll be, you know, freed up to pursue more noble ambitions than just like, you know, drudgery work. You know, they'll be able to pursue things like art and music and poetry and gardening and whatever. And, you know, definitely some people will, but I think for the most part, without some work to do, and I think work certainly gives people purpose, and without some work to do, you know, most people will probably fall victim to boredom and vice. And I think that is definitely reflected in the book. Yeah.
I love the idea, you know, people tell themselves, well, I think I'd love to do this. And people have an idea of some kind of pursuit that they think would be vastly entertaining. And after a couple of weeks of doing it, it's like, yeah, I don't really care about that, do I? And, you know, I don't want to, like Henry with his chair, Henry has some time off from work. I don't want to give away all the plot twists, but he finds himself with some idle time and he decides to make a chair. And it's really much harder and much less fun than he thought.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, we see it today, right? Like most people, whenever they, you know, a lot of people, and I'm not going to say most people, but a lot of people, you know, when they have free time, they just sit on the couch and binge watch episode after episode of Netflix. It's a totally, it's a totally passive activity, which And so I see that is where, you know, things could potentially go wrong when there's not work for people to do.
Yeah, because your free time is no longer valuable. It's just there all the time. So in the background of Henry's life, while he's sneaking away with his mistress and visiting the dive bar, politics take a strange turn. A liberal and dynamic president has a challenger, Henry, and his friends assume will never win. He's an anti-intellectual with an anti-progressive ideas. He does win, though. And Henry gets caught up in a surreal sequence of events. So I'm curious, did you finish your book before or after the U.S. presidential election of 2016?
So I actually, I wrote this book during, in 2016, during the election year, and while all this, you know, while the campaigning was going on, and I was living in, I was actually living in Hungary as, mm-hmm. when I wrote the book. I had been living in Albuquerque working for a company, and then I just decided to pack it up and move to Budapest. And so I did. And Budapest has, like, you know, a very, in power there, and he's been in power for a very long time, a right-wing, strong, authoritarian strongman, sort of demagogue named Viktor Orban. He's like a very, very competent version of what Trump mm-hmm. wants to be. And so he really was able to capitalize on, this populist sentiment. And things in Hungary are very different. Like they have a very long history of invasion, occupation. So people there are a little bit more right, I think, to be wary of, mass migration and people coming to their, changes in their country's demographic. But it was interesting watching the election in America from that vantage point. Everyone in Hungary was watching it going, most of my friends there, very liberal in the city. They're, successful artist type people. And they're thinking, this kind of stuff happens. Hungary's susceptible to like a right wing authoritarian strongman, but like there's no way this could happen in the United States. Mm-hmm. And so I was writing it while watching this, horror show sort of unfold in America. And I wrote probably 90% of the book leading up to the Trump's election, Trump winning the election. And then the ending I wrote after. I was very, very influenced by the 26th election. And in the book, it's the 2036 election. It very much mirrors what happened in 2016. And I tried to, in some ways, I'd say most of my friends and most of the people I hang out with have nothing but sort of contempt for the populists, whether it's Trump voters or Brexiteers or Orban supporters, mm-hmm. and I can definitely understand that, but I find myself a lot sympathizing with the populist sentiment. The world, I think, is changing faster than people can evolve, and changes that are occurring in the world, whether it's technology or globalism, there are an immense number of casualties because of all this rapid change, and it can lead to a lot of like resentment, and that can be a sort of a powerful motivator. But I also try and show in the book that any sort of revolution is probably almost most likely to usher in something that's like actually far worse for the people who most likely need help. And but I tried to at least show the populace I tried to show them in somewhat of be sensitive to what their cause is.
The factory worker and the dog and the bartender. I think Lydia, the bartender, is portrayed sympathetically, who she's replaced by machine. mixes drinks.
Sympathetically. That's the word I was looking for, but I couldn't find it.
Well, Indie Absolved computers not only perform our work, but they also create most of the commercially available music. And like I said, even make better bartenders. And yet the new president, who drags America back not only decades, but even centuries, is somewhere between a complete moron and a manipulative demagogue. So he doesn't seem to have a better answer. And so I'm just going to put this to you. If you were president, Matthew, what would you suggest for such a situation? Because I do think it's coming.
Yeah, no, I do too. I mean, I think, I don't think there's any stopping technological progress, no matter what, you know, someone like Trump or the fictional president in my book think. I don't think you can stop progress. With the book, I definitely wasn't trying to purport that I have any answers. My only goal, I think, was to sort of raise interesting questions. What would I do if I were president? I mean, that's like my absolute nightmare.
I was just gonna say.
To have to be responsible for the masses, you know? Like, I was thinking about this yesterday. Like, I work for this sort of big, fancy, VC-funded startup in New York City. And the company is, there's a lot of pressure on the CEO to just feed this huge machine to keep it going and keep growing and scaling. And I marvel at why anyone would want to be responsible for such like a large enterprise and be responsible for people's lives and people's money. And so, you know, thinking about being the president, like that sounds like the worst thing ever to me. And so, I think it's probably safer that I sit on the sidelines and write satire.
Well, all I can hope is, you know, I think about this too, that maybe there'll be off-world possibilities opening up, and that people who really feel a need to be challenged and occupied and aren't happy being absolved will get a chance to live in a, who knows, maybe another world that requires a lot of challenging skills that can't be performed by machine. I don't know. We can hope that challenges will continue to remain for people who need them to do their best. So you're an artist. You include musician among your passions. Here's just one last question. How do you feel about analytics that crunch data? I mean, they do in literature as well. And these analytics, for instance, demonstrate a popular preference to a certain arrangement of musical notes. Do you think this is helpful to creatives?
Maybe for some creatives. I'm kind of a Luddite myself. I'm pretty incompetent and unsavvy with any sort of data, and everything I do creatively is like basically like alchemy, I think. I don't really ever have like a plan. Like as I was going through this book, I didn't have the story mapped out or outlined. I was sort of just going day by day blindly. But yeah, I think definitely there are people who know how to use this data to achieve certain ends. And they're probably the people who know how to use this data to achieve those ends in the modern world are probably going to be the most successful.
At least the most profit. Will be made
most
perhaps.
Profitable, certainly. Yeah, I mean, when I look at the music that's, you know, the most popular music today, it's actually pretty impressive from like a composition structure, like what these producers are able to do. But it's very formulaic, and I guess maybe all music at some point, popular music, even you know, rock and roll and whatever, is formulaic. But at least it felt like, I don't know, at least it was being performed by humans, where so much of the music today is, I call it like laptop pop. It's just, you know, producers making music on the computer. They're not playing actual instruments. Like actual instruments actually sound offensive to young people now. It sounds, it's not like polished enough. It's not clean enough. It's not sterile enough. And like their sensibilities are almost offended by hearing like actual guitars and actual drums. They'd much rather, they're attuned.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. They need everything to be like, really sterilized. And that's what this like computer music, like all these pop stars today, you know, even their voice is run through, processors in order to get out any hint of like, you know, imperfection. And, you know, for past generations, it's often that those little imperfections is what we gravitate towards. And I think that, you know, these changes in the way people consume music and art, and it's very much affected by this technology.
Well, that's true. Things are getting very slick. I read, for instance, that in China, I believe it was China, or at least in Asia, that posting a picture of yourself that isn't worked through with some kind of Photoshop-like tools is just considered terribly gosh. Work through your image until it meets conventionally accepted norms, and then do you put it out in the world? So I guess everybody is going to me, perhaps some of the issue is conformity. If everything conforms to a norm, even if it's a norm that we hold to be aesthetically pleasing, it does seem like it will be somewhat of a dull world to me.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's not just in Asia, like the young people now. Yeah. Any picture they post on Instagram, they use, what you were saying, like this, like I think the app's called like Facetune, or, and they, you know, can tweak anything in their face. They can make themselves thinner. Like, I was sitting, with this girl at work who's maybe 24, I don't know. And she went to Miami to the beach, for the weekend before. And she was, you know, basically doing like post-production on her photos to post on Instagram.
Uh-huh.
And she had tweaked her foot to make it look thinner. Cause she was like sitting on a lounge chair in the picture and her feet were up, and she was tweaking her feet to make her feet look thinner, so her feet didn't look fat in the picture.
Well, see how the absolved will use their time.
Yeah, exactly. But this was like, I don't know, like a year ago when this happened. And that was the first time I had heard of this. And, since then I've asked around about this and everyone says, yes, of course, absolutely. Like nobody posts pictures unless, you know, they're tweaked to make them.
Oh, wow. Well, I live in a small town in Switzerland, so people haven't moved past the Facebook stage yet. I mean, there's no other, basically, social media that's being used a lot in this town.
Yeah.
Well, it's been really interesting chatting with you. And before I let you go, can you tell us, what are you working on these days?
So right now, I'm working on, I guess, two things. Music, always. I have a site, like a little recording project called Bang Bang Jet Away.
And where would we find those songs? Are any of them available?
Online you can find them at all the normal places, iTunes or Spotify or Amazon or whatever. And then we're going to do a small run of vinyl on our new album. We're going to do like just a small, like working with a label to put out just a couple hundred, 12 inches. And then also now I'm working. Yeah. And then I'm working on a screenplay. I met a guy in New York, a director named Zach Heiserling, who made a documentary a few years ago called Cutie and the Boxer that did quite well. He won like best director at Sundance, and the film was nominated for an Oscar for best documentary. And he and I became pals, and we were talking about The Absolved, and he was very interested in making a film about basically a Midwestern displaced trucker when truckers get sort of, which is part of The Absolved.
Yeah, that's coming soon.
Yeah, a truck driver who ends up losing his job to self-driving trucks, and then sort of the aftermath of that. So I just finished the screenplay for that, and now I guess we we'll shop it around, I guess, and see if we can get a movie made. So we'll see.
And what genre music would you, or just, we don't have to narrow it down too much, but just give us an idea of the band us the band name again.
The band name is called Bang Bang Jetaway, and it's, I'd call it like indie pop. Like for the new record, we've sort of, my friend, it's just myself and a friend named Mike Camus, and we've sort of gravitated away from, we both come from like definitely like rock and roll backgrounds, mm-hmm. but he plays violin and cello pretty well. So we've basically gotten rid of the electric guitars and sort of used, most of the stuff that we're doing now is piano based, and then a lot of the there's a lot of string arrangements, and you know, these are, we're actually playing them, they're not mainly Camus is playing them, I'm mainly playing guitar and piano and singing, but he plays everything better than me, but a lot of his playing on these records right now are the string arrangements, mm-hmm. and so yeah, it's really fun. It's definitely different than the fiction writing. So I like having both.
Okay, well, thanks so much for chatting with me today, Matthew.
Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me.
Thanks for listening to us today on the New Books Network Fantasy and Adventure Channel. I've been talking to Matthew Binder about his latest novel, The Absolved. To find out more about Matt, visit matthewbinder.net. And tune in next month when we talk to Madeline Miller, the author of Circe. I'm your host, Gabrielle Matthew, author of the historical fantasy Falcon series, which begins with A Falcon Flies Alone. You can follow me on Twitter to get updates about new podcasts and more. At Gabrielle Author, my name is spelled G-A-B-R-I-E-L-L-E. Till next time.